let's get started here. Apologize for the late start. We went over time on a conference committee hearing, and that's just the way it goes sometimes. And thank you for your patience. This is an informational hearing, as you know, and we'll start right off with Mr. Oberlander. He's here with an overview, and I'll go from there. Some members, as you can see, have other things going on, and I'm sure they're going to appreciate receiving copies of information that you have to present today, so keep that in mind as well. Mr. Oberlander, if you'd just identify yourself for the record and go ahead with your testimony, that'd be great. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Mark Oberlander. I'm the telecommunications manager at the Public Utilities Commission. And this morning, I would just like to give a brief overview of the access charge issue and arrangement. At this time, the Public Utilities Commission does not have a position on any bills that are currently circulating on this issue. Excuse me. To begin, access charges are the amounts that long-distance telephone companies pay to telephone companies to use the local telephone lines for originating and terminating long-distance calls. I think, as you know, long-distance companies sign up customers and bill them for their service, but the long-distance companies do not own all of the lines needed to provide long-distance service end-to-end. As shown on page 3, a typical long-distance call starts on a local line owned by one telephone company to switch to a long-distance line owned by a long-distance company and is switched at the other end to a local line owned by a second telephone company. Because of this physical arrangement, some financial arrangement is needed to compensate the local companies for the use of their local lines to provide another company long-distance service. So the access charge debate involves a question about money. How much should the long-distance companies pay to local telephone companies for the use of their local lines? The answer to this question is important to at least three stakeholder groups: local telephone companies, long-distance companies, and telephone service users. The amounts of long-distance compensation affect local telephone company overall revenues, profits, and rates charged for other services. Access compensation affects long-distance company expenses, profits, and rates for long-distance service. Access compensation also affects the rates paid by customers for both local and long-distance service. This topic has been addressed by the legislature in the past. Most specifically, the legislature has enacted Minnesota Statutes 237.12, Subdivision 3. And basically, that law says that telephone companies providing long-distance service shall pay compensation to the telephone companies providing local telephone services that includes a fair and reasonable portion of the cost of the local exchange facilities or local line used in connection with long-distance telephone service, including facilities connecting a customer to the local switching facilities and the common cost of companies providing a local service. The legislature has also enacted Minnesota Statutes 237.74, Subdivision 2, that applies to long-distance companies that are called telecommunications carriers under the statute. Going through that subdivision very quickly, no telecommunications carrier shall offer telecommunications services within the state upon terms or rates that are unreasonably discriminatory, no telecommunications carrier shall unreasonably limit its service offerings to particular geographic areas unless facilities necessary for the service are not available and cannot be made available at reasonable costs. The rates for a telecommunication carrier must be the same in all geographic locations of the state unless for good cause the commission approves different rates. A company that offered long-distance services shall charge uniform rates and charges on all long-distance routes and in all geographic areas of the state where it offers services. As a policy matter, this law ensures that telephone service users throughout the state can have the same long-distance services at the same rates. However, the law effectively requires long-distance companies to base their rates on their overall or average state costs, including average access charge costs. Different local companies have different cost structures and different access charge levels. Because of statewide cost and rate averaging, long distance rates are lower than access rates paid to some telephone companies, and long distance service is unprofitable in some parts of the state. The access charge issue is not a case of the good guys versus the bad guys with one clear answer. Any change in access charge levels, up or down, will change the financial condition of both the local companies and the distance companies. Some companies' finances will improve, and some companies' finances will deteriorate. Those companies whose finances deteriorate have three choices: accept lower profits, reduce investments in their networks, or raise the rates for some other service. So while reducing access charges could lead to improvements in the long distance business, it could also lead to reduced investment in the local networks needed for local calling, long distance calling, and internet services. It could also lead to higher local service rates that run counter to the goal of keeping telephone service affordable for all Minnesotans. In the end, any decision about changing access charge levels is a policy decision balancing the interests of the local telephone companies, the long distance companies, and the customers who use both services. And that's the end of my prepared remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Oberlander. Are there any questions, reactions to Mr. Oberlander at this time? Then we'll take questions at the end. I thank you for your testimony. And I'll note, too, that we have House File 3817 in our packet here dealing with the access restructuring as a point of taking off as well. Next up is Jim Burke. You can identify yourself, Mr. Burke, for the record, and proceed with your testimony. We're going to try to stay within a time frame here of close to noon as possible, so we'll keep that in mind.
Good morning, Chairman, members. Appreciate the opportunity this morning to talk about access charges. Sprint and AT&T are somewhat tag-teaming this issue from our perspective. I'm going to talk about history, what our access charges, and I'll try not to be redundant with what the previous witness just discussed. I'm going to talk a little bit about what some other states have done with access charges, what the FCC is saying with access charges, and then I will talk a little bit about what some of the rates are here in the state of Minnesota. Before I get into that, I'm the director of policy for Sprint Nextel. I've been with the company for over 20 years. I've been on both sides of this issue. When I was with the local telephone company, I was actually responsible for the collection of these switched access charges that we're going to be talking about. Then I went to the other side of the table where I was the payer of these charges. And now, Sprint being very diversified, I'm actually both a payer and a receiver and have policy responsibility both at a federal and state level on issues including access charges. So what are they? Previous witness talked about access charges. Again, I'm not going to be pretty too redundant here, but I may fill in a few blanks. Access charges vary greatly. depending on where the calls are made from and to, whether it's a call within the state, between states, also what types of carriers involved, are the local telephone companies, wireless companies, competitive companies, then what types of traffic, sometimes the rates vary depending on whether it's a wireline call, which you typically think of as traditional telephone service, whether it's a wireless call. The bottom line is that it's a very complex set of rules, both at the federal and the state level, that govern all of these inter-carrier compensation charges that apply to voice calls. Switched access, which is what we're specifically talking about, I mentioned intrastate. Interstate charges, calls between states, that's an expectation of the FCC, clearly. Intrastate, which is what we're talking about here, generally under the jurisdiction of these states. When we talk about access charges, we're typically talking about charges that apply to non-local calls or long-distance calls. The local calling area for wireline services determined by the state, typically by the commissions. From a wireless perspective, what is considered the local calling area, it's actually not called that, it's called an MTA, major trading area. That has been adopted by the FCC as what is considered local from a compensation or inter-carrier compensation from a wireless carrier perspective. Minnesota is made up primarily of one MTA. There's a small little sliver down in the very southeastern portion of the state, which is in a different MTA, but for the most part, Minnesota is one MTA, it's MTA 12. I mentioned FCC is the in charge of the interstate rates and states generally local rates. Now, the other form of intercarrier compensation, which this term may come up, is called reciprocal compensation. Whereas access charges apply to calls that are not local, reciprocal compensation applies to charges that are local in nature. So for telephone companies, it's calls within that local calling area. From a wireless carrier perspective, it's calls within the MTA. And the reason this change took place is back in 1996 when the Federal Telecom Act was passed. It created competition in the local markets, and they knew that there were issues with the intercarrier compensation scheme or system, and they identified, well, when companies are competing with one another, which is what that really started, competition for local telephone service, we really needed to have a different structure, and those rates are based on costs rather than having subsidies, which the access charges have in them. In many cases, those charges are zero between companies for these local calls. Costs for intrastate access charges can be a few pennies to many pennies, 20 to 30 cents a minute. And a little bit later, I'm going to talk about costs within the state of Minnesota. You have a handout that is three pages. The first one, I think, is comparable to what you just saw from the other gentleman, and this shows how access charges apply to long-distance calls. The long-distance company is the guy in the middle, and this particular call is left to right. So the customer on the left-hand side, I've identified that's a customer of a long-distance company. So that customer, that end user, is saying, I want XYZ company to be my long-distance company. Well, they only have one connection into their home. That is generally the telephone company. Could be a CLEC or an incumbent-like, as we call them. It's their connection. So that company assesses these access fees whenever that customer of a long-distance company makes a long-distance call. And then on the other end, when they terminate that, there's a telephone company on the other end. Again, it could be an incumbent local exchange carrier or a CLEC. They assess a fee on that other end. So there are two sets of access fees that are charged here. The charges are between carriers, intercarrier compensation. So the invoices and the checks flow between carriers, but at the end of the day, the end users are the ones that are paying these charges. At some point in time, they have to get passed on to the end users. The next page, then, which would be your page two, shows how this works for a wireless call. And again, this is for an inter-MTA call, which generally doesn't apply in Minnesota, but I think there's an important distinction. So here on the left-hand side, you have the wireless customer and the wireless company, and they transport the call to the telephone company on the receiving end, and they pay access charges when that's an inter-MTA call. The FCC determined a number of years ago, if a call were made in that reverse direction, from the telephone company customer to the wireless customer, the wireless company does not receive access charges. And that's important because what we're talking about here is a very old regime that was established back mid-80s when AT&T was broken up. And now the market is in vastly different. We're all competing with one another in one form, actually, more than one form usually. So we think it's time that this inter-carrier compensation scheme needs to be updated such that it accommodates this new competitive market that we're in. The FCC has recently recognized that the system needs to be changed as well. February came out with, the broadband plan, the FCC's broadband plan. And they addressed inter-carrier compensation specifically in that plan. And, you know, they identified several problems with that. One is what we call arbitrage. Arbitrage to some people is a bad thing. To some people, it's not so bad. I think it depends on what side of the fence you're sitting on. But because we have all these disparate rates, carriers sometimes will try to take advantage of a lower rate rather than the higher rate. Makes sense. You and I, we make those decisions every day, right? So this disparate set of rates creates the environment for this arbitrage stuff to take place. There's also another issue that they identified, and they called it access stimulation. Some people call it traffic pumping, whereby companies partner with like conference calling companies. They provide free conference calling. You call from all over the country. The access, these are long distance calls in a lot of cases, so this access meter is running, and the user of the conference calling service is not incurring any of that cost because the companies that are providing the conference calling service and the access charges, they're getting all of their revenue from the companies that have to transport that call and terminate it. That's an issue, several law states, numerous states, it's been before the FCC, but I think it's important to recognize that the FCC has identified this as a problem, and inter-carrier compensation is one way in which they think that they can address that. Another issue that the FCC identified with, inherent with the system is that the system is full of these subsidies. So why do we have these access charges? Well, the goal was to have universal service. Everybody in the United States should have an affordable telephone. So they built these subsidies in to these access charges so that long-distance companies would be paying the local companies, therefore the local rates, the rate that the end user actually pays for the service could be lower. That was the purpose. I don't think anybody is disputing that. But again, we think that the market has changed now, so we need to look at this system. So these rates are above cost, and it creates these situations that I mentioned. Another thing, and I know that Minnesota is looking at the whole broadband issue, as is as are many other states and at the federal level, to recognize that this current inter-carrier compensation scheme certainly wasn't developed with the intent of fostering broadband networks. Mid-80s, long time ago, we didn't have those things. We weren't concerned about those things back then. We are now. For example, companies are probably incented or could be incented today not to migrate their network to a broadband type of interconnection between carriers. Why? Well, because with this current scheme, I get a lot of revenue. So why should I change this and potentially get less or get no revenue? Identified by the FCC. Now, I'm talking a lot about the FCC, but we're here to talk about the state of Minnesota. If there was somebody here from the FCC, they would probably argue that they have the authority to adjust or change the rates for access charges within the state. That would be argued by a lot of people. I don't know if the previous gentleman representing the commission would argue that. A lot of state commissions would argue that the FCC does not have authority over intrastate access rates. But I think it's important to recognize the problem and really truly to fix it without being challenged. We can do it here in the states. Several states have done that. It's hard to keep an accurate toll of what has happened in different states, but there's been a recent effort, and I looked at that document. I was actually prepared for some proceedings in Wisconsin, and I counted 35 states that have made some form of adjustments, modifications to the intrastate intercarrier compensation scheme. They're not consistent, and some of them haven't gone all of the way. But I think it's a testament to what is going on. Within the last 6 months, I have, and maybe there are more, Virginia, Georgia, Michigan, New Jersey, Kansas, they have all addressed this issue. Right now, there are pending legislation in Missouri, Illinois, Pennsylvania, and Arizona. We got issued before the commission there. So there is a lot of activity to address intrastate rates going on within the states. Even though the FCC is kind of saying out here that they've got the ball, the FCC has had the ball since 1996. They've made improvements on the interstate side. They've actually reduced some of the interstate rates, removed some of those subsidies. If you look at your telephone bill, you'll see how they've done some of that. You have a slick or a subscriber line charge on your bill, and that's one way in which the FCC has tried to take the subsidies out of the interstate rates and put them on the rate payer, and the telephone company is allowed to charge. If you look at your telephone bill, you will see a charge like that on there, I'm sure. So we can do it here in the state. On the last page of what I provided you is a chart showing a comparison between interstate rates and intrastate rates in Minnesota. The high bar, those are the intrastate rates. That low bar, those are the interstate rates. And we've grouped some of these, but we've identified Quest, Frontier, CenturyLink, kind of grouped the small islets. There are a lot of them in Minnesota. We kind of grouped them together. And then the CLECs, we grouped them together on the right-hand side. I will note that rates such as this are filed in tariffs. This doesn't represent what the tariff rate is. This is sort of a composite rate, I would call it, to what Sprint pays. Sprint gets a lot of bills, and we try to estimate the number of minutes, and we kind of do some mass division. So this is representative of what would be a composite rate that Sprint pays within the state of Minnesota. So as you can see, there's quite a variation in the rates, and what we're suggesting the first step, which is consistent with what the FCC is suggesting is the first step, bring the intrastate rates down to the interstate rate level. That's generally what other states are doing when they're adjusting. They may not bring them all the way down, but they're bringing those two rates down as the first step. Now the FCC in their plan, which is a long-term plan, they think that this intercarrier compensation should actually be zero. We would agree with that. When we're competing with each other, we shouldn't be paying each other, especially if there are subsidies involved. It would be like Walmart and Target clearly compete with one another, and one of them having to pay a subsidy to the other one. That would create, and this is a term, a Minnesota term, a competitive imbalance. That was a term used in the Senate side. So a competitive imbalance is created when you have one competitor subsidizing the other competitor. At the bottom of that third page, I identified a couple of rates, and these are not our numbers, these are FCC numbers, but they're saying if we want to go to a cost-based system, and recall when they set reciprocal compensation for local companies that are competing with each other, those were cost-based rates. They've identified what cost-based rates might be for this type of service. As you can see, 0.2 cents if we use our traditional networks, narrowband networks that we do today, a broadband network, you know, a lot of zeros and a one. At that point, it probably doesn't matter very much.
Mr. Burke, if I may interrupt just again, because we're on kind of a tight time frame here, and I'll make sure we hear all folks on this matter. And I do want to have time for Connect a Nation to talk here yet, so I want to be able to get to them by 11:30. If you can finish up yours, and if Juanita, did you, Ms. Brown, did you want to? Will you be speaking to this issue as well?
Yes.
Tag teaming on that. Okay.
That's all I have prepared. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think we'll take questions at the end and maybe move right on to Juanita Brown. Thank you for your testimony and for the information. Welcome, Ms. Brown, if you'd identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Good morning, Chairman Johnson and members of the committee. My name is Juanita Brown, and I am Regional Vice President of Regulatory Affairs for AT&T. I'm responsible for regulatory affairs in five states, Minnesota being one of them. I see a lot of familiar faces around the table today. It's been a while since I've been here with you, so it's good to be back in Minnesota. But today, I wanted to make sure you all were understanding that I am here today as the long-distance provider of the operations of AT&T. As you guys all know, AT&T wears many hats. We're a wireless provider, we're a long-distance provider, and we are also a competitive local exchange carrier, or CLEC is what they're called. But today, as we talk, think of the issue of access charges in terms of it really impacts our long-distance operations. It will also impact our CLEC operations because that's the entity that assesses access charges while our long-distance entity pays access charges. And our wireless operations are minimally, if any, impacted by this whole discussion. So why do you need to think about reforming access charges here in Minnesota? Well, I think, as Mr. Bird said, the industry has changed dramatically since the point in time when access charges were first established back in 1983. Because at this point, technological changes have occurred, as well as market changes have occurred that really dictate that we need to take a hard look at the current mechanisms that are used for compensation of use of the network, because that's really what access is all about. What are you paying another company for the use of their network? Historically, back in 1983, access charges were set to preserve universal service. What we were trying to achieve as a goal back then was universal telephone service to all Minnesotans, all Americans. So access charges were set high to subsidize low local rates so that all consumers would have access to the service. If you think about back in 1983, the market, the local market at that time, was not competitive. You didn't have a choice of who you could go to for a provider. And competition really in the long distance market was just beginning. We had MCI entering the market, and that's the whole breakup of the Bell system. So let's fast forward now, 27 years later. Today, that market is entirely different, as we all know. Customers today have all kinds of options for local service, and they also have numerous options for long-distance service. The choices that they have range from traditional wireline service. They have the access to VoIP service, voice over internet protocol service. They can use wireless service. They can use services like Google Voice. The landscape has just changed dramatically since that point in time. And as you heard Mr. Burt talk about, so has the various compensation mechanisms for these various services, except for one. access charges and the compensation mechanism that was originally established has not been modified. And that's really what we need to look at doing now. Today, access charges remain almost in all states across the country, as well as at the federal level, above the cost. But the very services that, as I just said, that are using this network are paying different levels for the same use of the network. And so the artificial pricing that we've set up is really causing problems in our market today. And it's also, I don't know if this is causing feedback for everybody else, but it's also inconsistent with your goal here in the state of Minnesota of ensuring that broadband service is available to all of your citizens. You know, we heard earlier Mr. Burt talk about the FCC's National Broadband Plan, and in that plan, the FCC recognized that the current compensation mechanisms are not sustainable in an all-broadband internet protocol world where payments for the exchange of IP traffic are not really based on minute of use charges, but instead are based on the amount of bandwidth a consumer may consume per month. While broadband passes a large majority of the homes here in the United States, as well as here in Minnesota, and I think it's around 95% is what your penetration for broadband availability is here, there are not really that many consumers that are subscribing to broadband. I looked to see if I could find any statistics on take rates for specific to Minnesota, and I couldn't. But from a national perspective, about 66% of Americans subscribe to broadband. And so that leaves us really about 34% of consumers do not purchase broadband, where we've got a 6% rate of not having availability. So I think that we really should look at not only where do we not have broadband available, but we need to think about how do we get adoption increased? Because the adoption of broadband is a crucial piece of the puzzle. And if we don't successfully encourage Americans to adopt broadband, then our digital divide is going to just increase. So yeah, I'm always sitting here going, I thought she was supposed to be talking about access charges, and here she's talking about broadband. What's going on here? Well, to me, these two issues are very intertwined. And because I think you as policymakers need to think of it in terms of there are many perspectives for access and broadband. And you have to look at it from the consumer's perspective as well as the provider's perspective, not only of local but also of broadband. So first, let's just take a quick look at from a consumer's perspective. Part of the problem of broadband today and the adoption of broadband is really due, I believe, to the price points we have in the market for local service. Today in Minnesota, about 66% of the local exchange companies charge a rate for local service of between $8 and $15 a month, while 34% of the companies charge over $15 for local service. In a Senate hearing a week or so ago, the MTA said that their average local rate for their member companies was around $14. And that's really consistent with what I saw. And they also said that if they were forced to lower their intrastate access rates to interstate levels, that it would cause their companies to increase their local rates around $7 a month. So in essence, what the MTA said in that hearing was for $21 a month for local service, the subsidies that currently exist in access today could be equalized with the level of subsidies that still exist in the interstate. It would move the ball forward tremendously. And so while it's difficult for customers to think, oh, I'm paying $8 to $15 a month right now, somewhere in that ballpark, for local service. And if I go to broadband, I'm going to pay $25. But what would happen and what behavior might you see if you really did have customers to begin paying more closely the cost of local service and have them pay $20, $21? Now all of a sudden what's happened is Well, I'm paying $21, $20, $25, $4 a month. It eliminates that gap that is so large today to get adoption to occur. And it begins equalizing what's happening in the telecommunications market. So I also think we need to ask ourselves as policymakers, if local is being subsidized today, is it still appropriate in today's marketplace to continue that subsidization of local just for one segment of the market, which is basically wireline service? Now, I do think that you need to be careful, that you need to make sure that there are plans and funds available for consumers who may not be able to afford that $21 local rate that it would take. I think we need to maybe change our mindset from that we can't expect customers to pay this to, is it unrealistic to ask customers to pay more of their local service? Because really what they're trying to do is eliminate subsidies and drive behavior towards broadband adoption in doing so. You know, we had some focus groups here in Minnesota about a year and a half ago on this whole issue of access reform. And when we talked to those focus groups were made up primarily of rural constituents. And when they went through the focus groups and were told that their local services were being subsidized, they were offended. They didn't understand why in today's marketplace with the technologies that were out there, why are we only paying $8 a month? Why are we paying $12 if it really, you know, costs $21? Why is somebody paying the freight when I could pay it myself? They were deeply offended and said, Why are people allowing this to happen? So, you know, I think, will customers get upset that their rates are increasing? Yes. Okay. Does anybody want to pay more? No. Will they have grave reaction if you end up increasing local rates? Not if you put the appropriate mechanisms in place for those that have a true need and can't afford it. For the ones that can't afford it, then they are paying a better portion of their share of the expense.
And we're going to have to wind it down here.
Okay. I'm just going to go to one more issue because I think we need to look at it from the local company's perspective as well. And from that perspective, Mr. Burke touched upon it because in essence, they're really struggling. They're offering broadband, but they're not offering the full services that they can. And they're not offering those basically because their compensation that they receive is not commensurate with changing those services over to like a VoIP product. And so before you're going to see the full array of services offered by local exchange companies over broadband services, you are going to need to address the compensation mechanisms that are used to compensate them for the use of the network. I did have a chart that I had sent out that I had included in the package, I think, that just basically shows how in today's market, really what we're seeing is access lines are decreasing, minutes of use are decreasing. And so from an industry perspective, the compensation mechanisms that local exchange companies have historically depended upon are being eliminated or they are decreasing tremendously. So now is the time where you as policymakers need to look at this issue, address it, and move the ball forward. One of the reasons that I figured you'd think, well, why are you sitting here at the legislature asking us to do this as opposed to dealing with this at the commission? And one of the concerns that I really have is we have, since 1997, filed many proceedings at the Public Utilities Commission here in Minnesota, asking them to move the ball forward on this, and we've not seen any action. And so I would implore you to take action, to give direction to the commission, not let them have it on their own time frame, because it's not that this issue could not have been dealt with until now, but no action has been taken. So I would ask that you give clear direction to the commission to implement changes in this area.
Good.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. And members, the chart that Ms. Brown referred to, I don't think is in your pack, but we'll make sure it gets emailed out to you in the next couple days here. Mr. Lipschitz, do you need... willing to take a few moments. Thank you for your patience.
Mr. Chair. I will be very brief because I know time is short here. I'm representing a group of competitive local exchange carriers.
If you could identify yourself for the record.
My name is Dan Lipschultz. I'm here on behalf of a group of competitive local exchange carriers, or CLEX, as they've come to be called. Four of them in particular. They're the four largest in Minnesota: Integra Telecom, TDS Telecom, TW Telecom, and McLeod USA. Mr. Oberlander made a point, and I agree with him. There are really no good guys or bad guys in this debate, but there are consequences to any action you or any other body takes with respect to access charges. The question is, what are those consequences, and what's the compelling reason to move ahead and take the risks and incur those consequences? And I think those are questions you have to ask as you go forward, and I'm not going to take time because it would take far too much time, more time than you have, to try to answer those questions. But let's face it, when the dust settles and you talk about G3 networks, wireless versus wireline, broadband versus narrowband, at the end of the day, there's a local network, and almost all telecommunications traffic, wireless or wireline, eventually finds its way onto that network before it gets to you and I and the businesses and consumers in the state. And that network is a substantial cost. It costs a lot to deploy that network and to maintain it. Access charges are a big part of how costs for that network are recovered. Those are fixed costs. Those are big costs, and they're recovered over a long time frame. And if you start cutting back on one of the important sources of revenue that are used to deploy and maintain that network, there are serious consequences to consumers in Minnesota that you have to keep in mind as this debate goes forward and as you consider this issue. The bill that's not up for consideration today, but that we're talking about, would have every carrier in this state charge the same switched access rate based on what is charged in the interstate jurisdiction. And I'll just point out that not every local carrier has the same costs. The competitive local exchange carriers I represent are a tiny fraction of the size of the AT&T's, Verizon's, and Quest's of the world. We don't have the economies of scale and scope that the large carriers have, so you would expect our costs naturally to be higher. Should we be bound by the exact same rate to recover our costs that would apply or be charged by a much larger carrier? That doesn't seem to make sense either. So let me kind of flash forward to the FCC, and they are looking at this issue, and in their national broadband plan, they have a series of goals. One of the goals is a reduction in switched access charges. But let's keep in mind that the FCC has said that that goal will be implemented over a period of years and only after a number of proceedings. And there's a reason for the period of years, because of the consequences. If you're going to have consequences, you don't want to flash cut to a brand new rate that will substantially reduce revenue needed to support a network that we all rely on. Why a lot of proceedings before you actually implement this thing years down the road? It's because you have to look at the costs. You have to look at the consequences. These aren't just broad policy decisions. These are fact-intensive decisions. These are issues that relate to cost. They relate to the size and differences between companies. And there's an issue of due process. So my watchword, I think, on behalf of my clients to the legislature here is go carefully, go slowly, and rely on the expertise and fact-finding proceedings of the regulatory agencies, in this case, the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate it. And Mr. Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen. I'm Vice President of the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, and we're a trade organization that represents 85 local exchange carriers throughout Minnesota. We cover about 15% of the customers in the state of Minnesota and about half of the geography. So this is obviously a very serious issue to you. I won't go through all of my points here because a lot of them have been covered already, so I'll just kind of hit some of the highlights. Mr. Oberlander did an outstanding job of describing what access charges, what they are. One thing I think is important is, why are they different in the state, in different parts of the state? And the fact of the matter is, we have a lot of rural areas in Minnesota, and it costs more to deliver services to rural Minnesota. That's why access charges are different. Using the analogy that one of the previous testifiers did about the Walmart competition with Walmart and Target, That would be true if Target were using Walmart's buildings and Walmart's carts, but the reality is they're not. I mean, the long-distance companies have basically two choices. They can use pay access to us to use our networks, or they can build their own. And they've chosen, because it makes more sense, to use our networks. We think we should be compensated at a fair rate for that, and we think that that process is already in place to handle that. Mr. Olad didn't talk very much about the process for how access rates are set in Minnesota. They're tariffed by local exchange carriers, and they're filed with the Public Utilities Commission. Because there aren't a lot of choices for networks that they can use, long-distance companies do have an avenue when they don't think that they're paying a fair rate for access, and that's the Public Utilities Commission. There have been some rate cases and recently where long-distance carriers don't feel that they felt they've been paying too much for the network. They've gone to the Public Utilities Commission. They've worked out an amicable agreement. That agreement, and I can't even speak to it because it's very complicated, involves multiple aspects of the intercarrier compensation model, not just access. So to deal with access or to deal with intercarrier compensation, simplify it as being just access is not. So who pays for the access? Well, those are costs of doing business that the long distance companies incur. They pay that access charge to the local exchange carrier, and that cost is passed through into their business model. And this would be a tragedy if we had to shift that or that got moved all to the ratepayer. That is a cost of doing business. The other part of it is the network is never finished. You'll hear it, the network's been put in, it's been paid for, it's constantly upgrading. I had a hard time tracking Ms. Brown's analogies between access charges and broadband. I got confused in there. But the reality is that access charges and paying the service is what is developing broadband. Those access charges go into the network as part of the cost of doing business, and the local exchange carriers are using that to keep their network upgraded for voice services and developing that for next generation broadband. That is how broadband is getting deployed in Minnesota, and that's why we have such a high take rate. Most of this is irrelevant and already been testified to, so I'll stop now and take any questions if you have.
Well, feel free if you have any other points you want to make. You want to make sure you have enough time to do that, so.
Thank you.
Very good. Are there any questions for members from what the testifiers have raised thus far? And also, if there's anyone in the audience who wants to testify further about access charges, this would be a good time to do so. I don't see anybody jumping up from the audience, but members, any questions from the table here right now? Mr. Chairman. Representative Atkins?
I'm just ex officio, so I wanted to make sure nobody else had a question before I did. But is there any containment with either Mr. Christensen or Mr. Lipschultz? Can you charge anything you want to? I mean, is there anything that causes you to keep that within reason? And that I'm not trying to make that flip or disrespectful, but if you wanted to charge, 10 times what you're charging now, it strikes me that if I'm one of the carriers that came up and testified first, I'm trying to figure out when would it make sense for me to build my own network? And it strikes me that that's a very significant proposition for them. So can't you just charge anything you want to and set the price as high as you want?
Mr. Christensen?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, no. That's what the Public Utilities Commission does. They monitor the tariffs that we file. They make sure that we're charging reasonable rates, and that it's fair to the people purchasing the products, not just for long-distance services, but for all the services our members provide.
And Mr. Lipschultz?
Mr. Chair, Representative Atkins, there's a requirement in statute that rates be just and reasonable, and that's, just for starters, a roadblock to charging whatever you want to charge. I'll speak specifically for my clients, competitive local exchange carriers. There also is a market out there, and there is a lot of regulatory pressure and a lot of power and clout that the large inter-exchange carriers like AT&T have. So let me give you an example.
Several years back, AT&T, unhappy with the rates they were paying a number of my clients, stopped paying my clients. So what happens when you're a small carrier like the ones I represent who make in a year what AT&T makes in a couple of days? You say, what can we do? Can we work something out? And what happened was an agreement between a number of my clients and AT&T for substantially lower rates, which were then ultimately, after a PUC proceeding, tariff and available to all interexchange carriers. So there are a lot of forces out there, at least for my clients, that are in operation that have already brought our rates down from levels they were at previously. And I can give you examples. We don't have to do that here of the reductions just in the past few years.
So, Mr. Chair,
Representative Atkins,
gentlemen, so the point then is that they're both practical pressures with regulatory control. And because oftentimes it comes down to so long as we are comfortable with what the PUC does. And with my work of being on the PUC, I can't give them too hard of a time, I guess. But we have some very animated discussions about, you know, how they are doing their job, and I think for the most part they do pretty well, but some stuff I have some criticisms of, but I appreciate the points.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Atkins, that's a strong point, because while it may not move as fast or companies don't necessarily get the answers they want, the process has worked, and it continues to work today.
Mr. Chair, you might want to ask the industry, who do we have, AT&T and Sprint, if they think the process has worked, because they might have. I saw a little shake of the head behind him, and I appreciate the, but.
Mr. Burke, Ms. Brown, do you want to add something?
Ladies first.
Thank you.
Ms. Brown?
Thank you. Does the process work at the commission? I've worked here in the state of Minnesota since about 1998, basically, in the regulatory arena. And we have filed, before I ever got here, we have tried to address the issue of access charges at the commission. And yes, is there a process there? Yes. Is there a time frame at which a decision has to be rendered? No. And so what's happened is we've had numerous proceedings. We've spent numerous dollars trying to get this ball moved forward with no result. And so that's why I implore you to do something that gives specific instructions to the commission and set some time frames to it, because what we've experienced since 1997 has been inaction. The one proceeding that has resulted in something, which I think the MTA gentleman referred to, was filed in 07, and in this year, after that, the two companies met, and it was only between, it was with one company in the state, their access charges were reduced in numerous discussions. And finally, in March of this year, after a complaint was filed in 07, and it was an agreement, was something done. That same company filed a complaint against a separate company. They filed two when they did that, still pending. We don't even have a procedural schedule from a 2007 complaint filing to have a hearing yet on access charges. That is not action to me.
And Mr. Burke, do you want to add?
I think what Ms. Brown described is what we have seen in other states as well, where there may technically be the authority to address the issue. It's in a lot of cases not taken up. Other states have addressed the issue through the commissions. Minnesota, that's not happening. So, but I would like to step back and define the problem as we see it as a competitor. The market is vastly different than it was over a quarter of a century ago. It's obsolete. I don't think there's anybody in this room, probably, that would disagree with that statement. So the question is, how do you fix that? And I think the Walmart Target analogy is accurate. We are definitely competing as a long distance company. We are definitely competing with every one of the local telephone companies because they provide long distance service as well. What's a competitive imbalance in that relationship is that on that originating end of the call, they don't have that originating access per cost of what could be several cents per minute. We do. So it's very difficult for us to compete as a long-distance provider when we have this, what we call, unfair or unjust system set up. So it's really, how do we fix it? And Sprint doesn't disagree necessarily with a migration path. They certainly disagree with a 10-year plan. That is far too long. There will be people out of the business if this takes 10 years. We have seen this happen successfully in other states, do so very rapidly. Again, it gets back to what is the solution? What is the solution that we choose? The language that we have seen, we think it provides a lot of flexibility. We think it puts the decision of the how part, not the what. The what is, I think, your job. The how part is at the commission. They, you know, we talk in terms of dials that can be tweaked. There are a lot of them. Let the expert agency tweak all of these dials to figure out how. What we would like is certainty that it's actually going to happen.
Very good. We're going to switch gears here now. Thank you for your testimony. I think it's been a good discussion. It's an informational hearing, and clearly this is a matter we're going to be continue working on in the telecommunications division, and look forward to continue this discussion about it.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I appreciate your consideration. I did want to point out that to the extent my law partner is on the PUC, and we've got a recording being made and a lot of nice folks sitting here in the room, that we make a point of not discussing any pending matters before the PUC or any matters that are anticipated to be pending before the PUC, but do have 30,000-foot level discussions about the role of the PUC and the role of the legislature. Thank you very much.
Very good. Well, we're going to continue to move thoughtfully and carefully on this issue and look forward to some more discussion. We're going to switch gears now to Brent Legg. I see us sitting back there. Come on up and give us an update on what's going on in broadband mapping.
Sure. Give me just a second to get my computer set up for sure.
Mr. Legg, are you waiting for me to acknowledge you?
I am. I didn't want to be reasonable.
Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee for inviting me to speak to you this morning. My name is Brent Legg. I'm the Director of Stakeholder Relations and Development for Connected Nation. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization. Many of you have heard us present previously to this division, and we're happy to be back with you this morning. Just a brief overview for the members of the committee who may not have seen presentations given by us in the past. We are, again, a 501c3 nonprofit. Our subsidiary, Connect Minnesota, is a subsidiary nonprofit of ours. We have two primary offices in Washington, D.C. and Bowling Green, Kentucky. Our mission is to generate and support economic development across the United States by enabling the expansion of broadband availability and working to increase broadband adoption rates across the United States. Our subsidiary, Connect Minnesota, has partnered with the Minnesota Department of Commerce to update Minnesota's broadband inventory maps and collect additional broadband data as required by the National Telecommunications and Information Administration through their state broadband data and development grant program. We were the recipient of a $1.7 million grant that will fund our activities over the course of 2 years. We have just recently submitted data under the initial data gathering and mapping exercise under that grant program, and that's what I'm here to discuss with you this morning. Just by way of brief history of where we, how we came to this point, as you will most likely remember, we did undertake a mapping project here in Minnesota previously. An omnibus bill containing language to create the initial Minnesota broadband inventory map. That language was included in Senate File 3337, which passed the legislature on May 7, 2008, and was signed by Governor Valenti on May 12, 2008. The Department of Commerce was then charged with issuing an RFP for qualifying vendors to produce that map. Connect Minnesota, our subsidiary, submitted a bid and was subsequently selected by the Department of Commerce to develop the map for the state, and we were awarded that agreement or that contract in September of 2008. And between October 2008 and June 2009, Connect Minnesota developed the state's first inventory map and analysis of unserved areas. The final version of the map was produced under Connect Minnesota's original project and was released to the public on June 30th, 2009. This is a snapshot and a very high level 30,000 foot view of that original map as of June 30th, 2009. And this is a snapshot of our original interactive map, which will be greatly improved under this current mapping program. And I'll show you a demonstration of the new interactive mapping tool, which I think you'll find to be very impressive toward the end of my presentation. The project objectives under this new mapping initiative to build and further develop working relationships with Minnesota's broadband providers and to support a general environment of public-private sector collaboration on broadband issues among all stakeholders involved. Number two, and probably most importantly, to update and improve Minnesota's detailed maps of broadband coverage and launch a new, robust, more user-friendly interactive map. To utilize the resulting maps to accurately pinpoint remaining gaps in broadband availability. To assess the level of connectivity, and this is something new as part of this grant. To assess the level of connectivity currently provided to Minnesota's what's called community anchor institutions, and those are schools, libraries, hospitals, local government offices, etc. Fifthly, to assess broadband use among Minnesota's businesses and residents, and to identify barriers to broadband adoption, and that is also something new as part of this grant. And finally, to support the work of the successor to the Minnesota Broadband Task Force whenever that is created, as may be needed. In terms of current status, this past Friday on April 30th, Connect Minnesota submitted an initial data set to NTIA representing broadband data from 100 unique broadband providers across Minnesota. That represents about 83% of the total provider community, 100 of about 120 unique providers identified. Of those 100 providers, 94 are included on the updated broadband map, and six of those are exclusively middle mile or backhaul providers, and those providers cannot be mapped per NTIA's guidelines for confidentiality. However, the data, that data that we did collect for those six providers was provided to NTIA as required. Of the 20 providers that are not represented on this initial submission to NTIA, two providers have either refused to participate or have remained unresponsive to numerous contact attempts by our team. And 18 providers are currently in some form of progress toward data submission, but were not able to either submit or verify their coverage areas at the time that we needed to submit the data to NTIA. We will be, and I'll discuss this in a little bit more detail in just a second, but we will be, this grant is for the mapping portion of our work is for 2 years. To refresh the data on the maps on an ongoing basis, and we will be making official submissions to NTIA with updated data every 6 months. So the next submission to NTIA will be in September. In terms of key findings, 95.55% of Minnesota households have access to broadband service of at least 768 kilobits per second downstream. That leaves 4.45% of Minnesota households that are unserved, representing approximately 93,000 households. In the first figure, there are approximately 2.1 million households total in the state of Minnesota. So there are about 2 million served households and about 93,000 unserved households in the state. And that's at the lowest FCC definition of broadband service at 768 kilobits downstream. The map that we have produced from this initial data collection exercise will be released to the public on May 17th, although because I'm giving this presentation to you today, it sort of already is public, but it will be available on our website and available through, most importantly, the interactive format that we call Broadband Stat. You'll be hearing a lot about Broadband Stat in future weeks. That's our interactive mapping tool that we've developed with the GIS company called ESRI that does GIS mapping, not just for broadband, but for all infrastructure applications globally. We developed this tool. Broadband Stat is a phenomenal product, and again, I'll demonstrate that in just a few minutes. The maps will be, as I said, continuously updated for a period of at least 2 years, and we're hoping NTIA will make funding available for the full 5 years, which was the original scope of the grant program, and they reduced it to 2 years and said that they would evaluate toward the end of this year the success of the initial program, and they may award up to 5 years of funding. We are hoping that they will do that, of course, so that the maps do not fall out of date after the initial two-year program is up. Our engineering and technical services division and our research division are going to be undertaking an ongoing process of validating the data on the map. We're also going to be engaging in a fairly robust outreach campaign to the public to invite public stakeholders to visit the website, take a look at the map, and offer feedback. And we will respond to every inquiry that we receive from the public regarding the accuracy of the map. And as I said previously, no map is ever going to be completely accurate, but our goal is to strive to be as accurate as we possibly can be and to tweak it and modify it as needed over the course of the term of our grant. Again, this is the snapshot of broadband that we created as of June 30th, 2009, and this is the updated broadband map as of this past Friday. As you can see, as I toggle back and forth between the two maps, the orange color represents fiber to the home service. And since June 30th of 2009, there has been a significant increase in deployment of fiber to the home, especially in northwest Minnesota. There's also been a fairly significant increase in fixed wireless deployment, specifically what's called WiMAX. And according to our engineering team, most of that new deployment has been happening in the center part of the state to the northwest of the Twin Cities. There has been a number of changes.
Can you just flip maps again real quick for the benefit of everybody?
Sure.
Thank you.
And again, this will be in a much more user-friendly format when we launch Broadband Stat during the week of May 17th, and you'll actually be able to zoom in, do an address search, and be able to see a much more granular level of detail than what you can see on this map. But as I toggle back and forth between the two, you can see as the orange area appears up there in the northwestern part of the state, that there's been a significant deployment in fiber over the course of the past year.
Thank you.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, just a brief overview of the Broadband Stat web application. It truly is a phenomenal product, and you'll see why in just a second. It really is the nexus between just mapping broadband and actually turning it into a planning tool for the future. It's very customizable, and it will allow the state and the Broadband Advisory Group or Task Force or whatever is formed, or which may be formed in the future, to do a number of things that were never possible before. Several of the things that it will do, it will allow for users to search and identify broadband service at a specific address, including available speeds and service providers. It will allow the state to understand and track broadband deployment over time so that you can see changes as they are made to the broadband landscape over time. It will allow the state to analyze and prioritize unserved and underserved areas using population and household density information. It will allow the state to track Recovery Act funded broadband projects. It will allow the state to build and evaluate scenarios to help score and prioritize future broadband infrastructure proposals should Congress make additional funding for broadband infrastructure available. And it will allow the state to track broadband adoption rates and barriers to broadband adoption across Minnesota, which, as we've heard in earlier presentations today, is a very important thing. So I'll switch gears just quickly and give you a brief demo of Broadband Stat. This is actually Broadband Stat that was launched in the state of Illinois. As I said, Minnesota's map will be available via Broadband Stat during the week of May 17th, and we're going to make a pretty aggressive push to promote the map in the media. So you'll probably be hearing quite a bit about that here in a couple of weeks. This is the only live version that we have. We are actually mapping broadband availability in 12 states plus the territory of Puerto Rico under this grant program, and Illinois is the first state to launch in this interactive format. As you can see, this tool is based on something that you probably had a bit more experience with when you get online and map a specific address via Google Maps or Bing Maps when you're looking for directions to a certain location. This tool is set up to function much like that, where the interface is much more interactive. You can drag the map, you can move it back and forth much like you would a Google Map or a Bing Map online. We can, there are zoom in and zoom out tools that make it much easier to zoom out and in. And I will say that as Minnesota's tool is launched and you take a few minutes to play around with it, every time we create a new view here, it takes a second to refresh the coverage that you can see here on the map. So as I zoomed out, it took a few seconds for it to populate the coverage in this one. But what you are seeing here on the screen, and there's a button here where you can pull up the legend, and there will be a legend box that will pop up to the right-hand part of the screen. You're seeing cable service in this shot, you're seeing DSL service, you're seeing a little bit of fiber, and you're seeing fixed wireless service here. And you can actually click on in this box, and the color code will come up. So the pink is cable coverage here, and I'll zoom in just a bit again so you can see it a little better. And again, it's a second for the level of granularity on the map to refresh. But what you're seeing in the shot once the coverage refreshes here is that the pink area, this is cable service provided in this particular town in Illinois. DSL service is indicated in a light purple color. Fiber is in orange here. Fixed wireless service, and you can't see it on this particular view, but that would be in green. And then we have unserved areas, which I'll show you in just a second. And this is really where the power of the broadband staff tool comes into play, is analyzing the unserved areas that still exist. I can add and remove, and as soon as the image refreshes here, I can add and remove coverage layers. So if I just simply wanted to look at cable service, I could deselect DSL and deselect fiber and deselect fixed wireless. And it's going to remove those layers from the screen, so you can just take a look at one particular service type. I can also remove everything and highlight unserved areas. And the so everything now that you see here in color are census blocks that are color-coded by household density. So if you take a look at the legend along the right-hand side of the screen here, everything in yellow represents a census block with 0 to 8.49 households per square mile. So the areas, the census blocks here that you see here in yellow, are the least populated areas, the areas where houses are spread further apart, and any of the broadband service providers that are in the room here today will tell you that it's generally more expensive to deploy broadband service to areas where households are spread further apart than they are when they're closer together. But we can see here that there are a few census blocks that are darker in color, that are still unserved and have a fairly high household density. And so you'll actually be able to do this very same type of analysis when the Minnesota tool is launched. You all see essentially where the low-hanging fruit still exists in the state, where broadband service is not currently being provided, but could be done in a fairly cost-effective way. And the power of this tool is that none of this data has been assembled in one central location before, and now it is going to be available to anyone that wants to see it. And so if I, for instance, wanted to take a look at this particular darker census block here that is unserved, I can click on the Identify tool along the left-hand side here, and another box is going to pop up here on the right. And I will actually be able to select as soon as the box pops up, and again, it does take a second depending on the speed of your internet connection to bring up the tool sets. But I can actually click on this button and select unserved from the drop-down box and click on this particular census block, and it's going to draw the boundaries of that census block in red. And it's going to pull up some data that tells me that there are 22 unserved households within that census block. That the square mileage is 0.067 square miles. That there are two served households there. And this census block is considered rural for a total of 22 households total within that block. I can click on other census blocks and get the same type of information. And this is this had NTIA saw fit to produce the maps before they had awarded billions of dollars in broadband infrastructure money during the last two rounds of funding. Broadband providers would have been able to utilize this tool to effectively target those investments and demonstrate to NTIA that these are truly unserved areas. And so if Congress does see fit to make funding available for future broadband deployments, this tool is going to be very useful to the state broadband task force or advisory committee and individual providers themselves to effectively target unserved areas that remain. I mentioned that you can search for a specific address. You can do that by clicking on the little thumb pin up here in the top left-hand corner. Another address box will appear on the right-hand side of the screen. And you can type in an address and literally zoom to a specific location, much like you would on Google or another type of map. And finally, two more points on the broadband stat tool, and then I'll move on. And again, here's the address box. So you can, you'll be able to type in your street address and an address, city, state, zip, field will come up here where you can type that in. But another feature of this new interactive tool is that if you create a view, like if you customize a view that you particularly like, you can print a copy of that view, you can email a copy of it to someone if you want somebody to take a look at a specific area, you can bookmark it and come back to it later. And these are all available in these tool in this tool set here, located next to the address location feature. So we'll close these boxes. And the other great thing that is available now is you can actually apply, instead of the map view, you can view aerial imagery or satellite photography of a specific area. So you can actually see the physical structures with the broadband coverage layers overlaying on those. And it's a much more friendly and useful tool than the previous version of the broadband map that was available. And so again, you can zoom in and it takes a second for the layers to refresh, but it provides a much more accurate and granular view of coverage than what we had previously. So any questions, Mr. Chair, about broadband stat before we move on?
For information?
Just, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lake, does the mapping data now indicate whether the local cable operators have provided infrastructure and services to the commercial and industrial areas as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, are you speaking specifically about like industrial, like enterprise zones, or are you just talking about general availability to businesses?
Let's try the general availability.
Yes. The map does indicate where cable providers or other types of broadband providers are offering service at a business grade to businesses across the state. So yes, that would be a question for me, yes.
Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Legge, I'm just wondering, do you have a data layer that tells the names, that identifies the companies that are doing the providing?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, I can demonstrate that, and I should have at the beginning, and I appreciate you calling my attention to it. If you click on the address box and type in a specific address, you can identify the broadband service providers that are providing service at that specific address. So if I were to type in, for instance, 100 Main Street in Marion, Illinois, the application would zoom to that specific address, and it would list the broadband service providers that are providing service at that address, and then also provide a link to that service provider's website.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one quick follow-up. Going back to the maps that showed the difference between 09 and 010 development, and looking at the change in the fiber in some areas, could you just tell me quickly, are those predominantly co-ops that are providing that service, or are those other private companies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Saylor, I think most of the, I think a lot of the deployment is taking place by privately operated companies. There are also cities, municipalities that are deploying service out there. It's really a mixed bag of service. The rural telcos have been very aggressive in deploying fiber to the home service in areas across the state. As I mentioned, we've started to see companies that provide telephone service that are also starting to provide fixed wireless service in remote rural areas via forms of technology like WiMAX. And this is something new as compared to the exercise that we undertook previously. But it really is a mixed bag in terms of the investment that has been made. It's been private companies, it's been cities, municipalities, and it's been wireless companies, fixed wireless companies, small wireless companies, and large ones too. So.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Legge. Mr. Hockey? Dr. Hockey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Legge, I would assume that broadband companies already have this information or similar information to this on their own. and that they're out in parts of Minnesota and the rest of the country out developing things. So does your company sell this information to broadband providers?
Actually, all of this information, Representative Hobby, Mr. Chair, actually comes from the broadband providers. So the data that they have on their existing networks, we receive in a variety of formats. We convert that data into geocoded information that can be applied to a GIS product like this one. And we translate that into a visual depiction of their coverage area. And once we receive that data from them, we send that back to them for them to approve before we apply their coverage to the aggregated statewide map. Most providers do, the larger providers anyway, do have this sort of information available for their own network, but they in most cases don't have that information for their competitors or for other providers within the state. And so this is an exercise that brings all of that data together in one place to allow for a comprehensive picture of where service exists and where it doesn't.
Thank you.
Well, sir, happy?
I'll pass, Mr. Chair.
Well said. Concluding comments, Mr. Lake?
Just briefly, I wanted to mention that we are, and I did touch on this very briefly at the beginning of my presentation, that we are going to be undertaking a research project on broadband adoption and broadband use for both residences and businesses across the state. The residential survey is underway right now. The business survey will be undertaken later this year. And the goal of this research work is to understand where the digital divide exists in the state. So we will be assessing adoption rates. So there will be actual adoption figures. I know that Ms. Brown from AT&T mentioned earlier that she couldn't find any adoption-related statistics for broadband and for the state. Our research effort will fix that problem. We are also going to be trying to understand how different demographic factors impact adoption across the state, how monthly subscription costs, where those are high, where those are low, and completing an analysis of that issue. We're going to be tracking computer ownership rates across the state and trying to understand what awareness of computer literacy issues exist out there, too. And so we will be issuing a report and analysis based on this research work over the course of the late summer, probably in July or August of this year. And Mr. Chair, that really concludes my presentation.
Good. Very good. Thank you for your testimony and for your presentation. It was very helpful. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Mr. Mitchell, so you're on the list here. You want to? Identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Christopher Mitchell. I'm with the Institute for Local Self-Reliance. Been confused with Miller's in the past, but no problem. I'm a broadband researcher. We focus specifically on networks that are put the community first in our view, includes cooperatives, nonprofits, and public entities. I had a couple of concerns, one of which has been concluded, I would say. The first would be that in our spot checks of data, we found that it seems to overrepresent what's truly available. I do not trust the 95% figure. The spot checks I've done, as a broadband researcher, I talk frequently with friends and family, and sometimes family of friends, whether they appreciate it or not. And when I plug those numbers in, I often find speeds that are represented that they cannot get. In the case of only one example, in down in Wells, outside Albert Lea, they're supposed to be able to have achieved between 3 and 6 megabits on the DSL. When they ordered their DSL and they got it was so slow, they had trouble differentiating between that and their dial-up connection, which is not a matter of, as some people often will say, that there could be congestion on the line. These are not people who are doing file sharing. It was simply that the data rates were not available to them. As we all know, DSL degrades over distance, and I think these distances are greater than represented. I think the speeds are much slower. Additionally, on a personal story, my parents have a slow connection, which actually it meets what's advertised, which I'm happy to see. It's advertised as being 1 megabit per second. It's the fastest, and it sometimes exceeds that. However, they have to pay $80 a month for that. And so to the extent that these maps do not demonstrate, show what cost the speeds are available at, I don't think they're particularly useful. This is not a criticism of Connected Nation. They've not been tasked with providing the costs. I think that from a policy standpoint, however, without cost information of how much a service is available for, we're not going to be able to make very intelligent decisions. I had some criticism about the online map tool, which I think have been resolved. The new tool is vastly improved. The old tool, even on my faster connection in St. Paul, being a tech geek, I pay for a fast connection. It was very slow to update. It was incredibly painful to use their tool. And I'm glad that it will be better, although it looks like it still is rather slow. And my analysis would suggest that this is something that this is just totally off the seat of my pants. It's a lot of server-side technology, and I wonder if perhaps they need to put more resources into the servers to make sure that that's delivered faster, because there's no reason that a connection here in this building it should be so slow to update. That's in every second that it takes while you're waiting for something to happen, you're losing users from using the tool. Lunch is coming, and I think I will confine myself to that. I do want to note that to a certain extent, while I think we could use better maps, I don't think the mapping should slow us down from enacting policies to achieve the goals that you've set into law. I think that what we've seen is some of the fastest networks in this country, which I've identified in a report that I've just released this week, are cities that looked at their DSL and cable in some situations and said, these are decent services, they're available to the average Americans, but they're not good enough for us, and they put in fiber to the home networks that are now among the best in the country and some border on competitive in the world. And so I would say that while I do criticize the maps and I find them lacking, that it should not stop us from enacting other policies while we wait for better maps. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Mitchell? Seeing none, the members, the meeting's adjourned for today. Thank you for coming. Thank you for attention.